Thank you. Good morning. As a lifelong student of history, I agree with Michael Crichton, who said, "If you don't know history, then you don't know anything. You are a leaf that doesn't know it's part of a tree." George Orwell was even more pointed about it. He said, "The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history." By the end of my speech, I want to show you how that is happening to us right now in our fight for the renewable fuel standard. Orwell wrote the book 1984 in 1949. I read the book 1984 in 1984 for my freshman English class, a choice inspired more by the Van Halen album that came out in January of 1984. There are many lessons we can learn from Orwell's insight and brilliance. So on the 65th anniversary of the book and the 30th anniversary of the actual year, it makes sense to take a look at the lessons we can learn from Orwell and how they apply to our own history of energy, technology, and the role of government policy. One of Orwell's main messages in 1984 was how both destructive and dangerously effective historic revisionism can be. Biodiesel's story is an example of how effective government policy can be to jumpstart a fledgling industry. But guess what? That is the story of nearly every new industry that involves technological development. Strong government policy support, along with a unique spirit of innovation, entrepreneurship, risk-taking, they're the primary reasons that so many major modern industries had their start in America. The petroleum industry, the automotive industry, the railroad industry, electricity, aeronautics, aerospace, nuclear energy, hydroelectric, semiconductors, communication satellites, GPS. It's the reason Silicon Valley is in San Jose and not Tokyo. These modern revolutionary industries all had their origins in strong policy support, whether it was original development of a technology from the military or NASA, or whether it was research, tax support, or other policy backing. What we've learned from 140 years of experience in this approach in developing new industries is A, it works, and B, sometimes it works too well. It can spawn robber barons who build ruthless monopolies that stifle competition and innovation, and it sometimes takes effective policy to reestablish diversity and competition. The renewable fuel standard is exactly that kind of policy. It's fulfilling its intention to establish diversity, competition, and choice in the transportation fuel sector, which is why the incumbent industry is trying to kill it. Now, I'm a fan of free market capitalism, but there is nothing free about the global or domestic petroleum market. According to multiple Congressional Research Service reports, Office of Management and Budget, Joint Committee on Taxation, under different administrations and congressional majorities, petroleum has had the most government support and for longer than any other industry. I also want to make clear that for the rest of my speech, when I refer to the oil and gas industry, I'm not referring to our partners in the petroleum industry, the marketers and distributors and retailers, the mid and downstream folks, many of whom are here with us today, including our chairman. I'm talking about big oil, the upstream refiners, drillers, the integrated multinationals, the obligated parties, the ones who have made it their top priority to eliminate the RFS. Now, we have nothing against people who have chosen petroleum extraction and refinement as a career. Our modern society is based on petroleum. It's brought us much prosperity to human existence. And we'll continue to need all types of domestic energy for a long time. But there are obvious consequences to singular reliance on petroleum in the transportation sector. And when you have the richest, most profitable industry in all of human history that has the power to eliminate you and has made it their top priority to do so, it's important to provide as fierce a defense as possible. So that's what you're going to hear from me this morning. But I pledge to do so with truth and facts and data, and not just opinion and unjustified assertions. So if you're here representing a big oil company, welcome. We're glad you're here. But I have to warn you, you're about to get an earful about about your industry's attack on the RFS. Now, Big Oil has a very simple message that appeals to policymakers and the public, which is the shale oil boom is going to make the U.S. energy independent with our own oil. We shouldn't be having these expensive mandates and subsidies to support renewable energy boondoggles. We should have a free market. That's great, right? It sounds very plausible. But how do they justify their own subsidies and 100 years of government policy support? Easy. They just flat out deny they exist. In Orwell's 1984, Big Brother had a ministry of truth which was responsible for propaganda and historical revisionism. Big Oil is counting on the public and our elected leaders to forget history and to be completely confused by complicated tax policy. And guess what? It's working. The oil and gas industry's idea of bringing more diversity and choice and competition to the transportation fuel sector is that Americans should be using more of both kinds of energy, oil and gas. Take a look. Now, I'll address the history of government support for the petroleum industry in a minute in detail, probably more detail than you like. But first, I want to tell you another story about how government policy support, along with capitalism and risk-taking, can be effective in launching industries. I could give you numerous examples, but I chose computer technology. In the early days of the nuclear age, the Pentagon was racing to develop an air defense system against Soviet attack. They brought in MIT to transition punch card technology to what became random access memory. And then they brought in a little company called IBM to develop it into the first modern computer. Now, these were huge machines, enormously expensive, with very little market. Nobody had enough money to buy these things. So the government stepped up and started buying IBM's product that they had paid IBM to develop in the first place. The first six multi-billion dollar computers were purchased from the U.S. government. By the late 70s, IBM dominated the computer industry worldwide. But then it shrugged off the emerging personal computer market because they thought that it wouldn't amount to anything. It was not until Apple became the fastest growing corporation in history that IBM finally introduced the IBM PC in 1981. So an epic battle ensued with small startups all trying to compete with one of the largest multinational corporations in the world. So by 1983, dozens of personal computer companies had been mowed down or gobbled up by Big Blue. And IBM, after having ignored the personal computer market at first, they now wanted to have it all by crushing all competition. So one relatively small company was poised to stand up to the juggernaut. In 1983, Steve Jobs had headed up a new project that would change the computing world forever. It was one of the last things standing between consumer choice and a virtual monopoly in the computer industry. This week marks the 30-year anniversary of the introduction of the Macintosh computer, introduced January 24, 1984. Mac was unveiled with one of the most effective marketing campaigns ever, invoking George Orwell's 1984. Take a look. Now, Apple came dangerously close to being snuffed out, but ultimately, it was able to stand up to Big Blue and not only help revolutionize personal computers, but go on to create new technologies that revolutionized the music industry, the cell phone industry, pods, pads, smartphones, and Apple continues to innovate. It turns out that 1984 was a pivotal moment that had Big Blue had its way, all of that incredible innovation would have been eliminated. Now, I want to talk about another industry that started in America, the petroleum industry. Started in 1959 when commercial drilling was first discovered in Pennsylvania. The U.S. was the only commercial producer of oil and subsequently the world's leading producer of oil, used in kerosene lamps for the next 50 years. Now, when Henry Ford introduced the Model T in 1908, making the automobile affordable, suddenly there was a huge market need for gasoline. There was far greater demand for gasoline than there was supply. So the federal government set about handing over government lands and easements for drilling and grants for infrastructure and research support. And it worked. It was effective. Created an oil boom in Texas and Oklahoma and California. Then in 1913, 100 years ago, the 16th Amendment established a permanent federal income tax for both corporations and individuals. And from the beginning, Congress established permanent tax breaks for the young oil industry to help it get ramped up to meet the demand for gasoline and the growing car industry. And from then on, it has been the policy of the U.S. government to support, subsidize, and incentivize petroleum in an attempt to keep domestic supplies stable and keep energy prices low. Let me read you the first line of a 2007 Congressional Research Service report. Tax incentives for oil and gas have historically been an integral, if not the primary component, of the nation's energy policy. Goes on to define a subsidy as any tax code preference, and then it lists some subsidies there, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. One reason the petroleum guys can get away with saying that they don't get any government policy support is that the majority of the general public are not particularly interested in how multinational corporations utilize the tax code. I happen to be a CPA, so I'm a little more interested than most, but only a little more. The oil and gas industry has said that new production from shale oil will help us become completely energy independent with our own oil, which will lead to lower fuel prices for U.S. consumers. They claim that they will do this without any government support. Okay. First of all, shale oil is extractable because of technologies of horizontal drilling, microseismic energy imaging, and hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. The U.S. government provided billions of research dollars to develop these technologies for use in shale development in the 70s and 80s. They also provided significant tax benefits to incentivize their expansion. This technology wouldn't be here today without that government support. In addition, the fracking of shale oil and gas receives multiple subsidies. Going to list some of them. I'll go through it quick. I don't want to lose you, but try to stay with me. It's boring. First of all, percentage depletion deduction. This is a deduction where they get to write off more than their actual cost. That is a subsidy. Some cases, much more than their actual cost. They get a non-conventional petroleum tax credit. These credits for fracked gas and oil increased to $4.5 billion a year in 2007 when it expired after several decades. They get to immediately write off intangible drilling costs. This is a capital cost that should be amortized, but they get to write it off the very first year. This is a specific tax break or subsidy to the oil and gas industry. Some companies are allowed to take an enhanced oil recovery credit for fracked gas and oil when oil drops below a certain amount. And this is the doozy. Some companies are allowed to set up master limited partnerships, which means they pay no corporate income tax. Now, this structure was specific tax breaks to oil and gas companies. Renewable energy companies are not allowed to do this. There are 111 oil and gas companies that are set up this way that are paying no corporate tax. How's that for a tax break? In addition to that, the 2005 energy bill that started the renewable fuel standard was heavily supported by the petroleum industry. Why? The bill was developed by an energy work group headed by Vice President Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton, the company that licenses fracking technology. The bill exempted fracking from portions of the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Superfund Law, the National Energy Environmental Policy Act, and about a half dozen other environmental regulations that every other industrial sector has to comply with, including biodiesel producers. It not only gave fracking a pass on environmental laws, we don't even know the direct or indirect environmental consequences that fracking of oil and gas is having on the environment because the 2000 law conveniently prohibited the EPA from regulating or even disclosing what chemicals they're putting into the ground. More than 500 different toxic chemicals are used as drilling fuels, drilling fluids, and tertiary injectants. That's some pretty powerful public policy support right there. I'm not saying it's good policy, especially if you're one of the people who's had their drinking water contaminated, but it is powerful policy. Fracking has exploded in the last 5 years. It's literally changed the American landscape. Here's another example of fracked oil and gas receiving preferential government policy support. In the original carbon analysis for RFS2, the EPA assumed up to 4 iterations of indirect effects for biodiesel, modeling future actions by individuals on other continents in future decades and assigning those carbon impacts back to current biodiesel. They likewise assumed no indirect impacts for petroleum. Now, we know that none of the impacts predicted in the modeling for biodiesel came to pass, while observable impacts from the fracking boom clearly came to pass. Yet rather than go back and redo the carbon analysis to calculate the observable impacts that are happening with the fracking boom and correcting the projected indirect effects that did not happen with biodiesel, the EPA is still using the old projections from 7 years ago. It is clearly evident that biodiesel continues to decrease its carbon intensity, and petroleum continues to increase its carbon intensity, just like we said it would back in 2009. Yet all of the government's numbers continue to reflect the opposite assumptions. The petroleum industry was the first industry to spawn multinational corporations. And to this day, it is the only one, it's one of only three global industries that are manipulated by an international cartel: diamonds, illegal drugs, and oil. Cartels are entities that exist specifically to manipulate supplies and prices of their products. Cartels are illegal in virtually every industrialized country and by the WTO. As the CEO of a U.S. trade association, if I allowed attendees of an NBB meeting to have discussions that involve manipulations of supplies and prices, I could go to jail. Yet this is the stated reason that OPEC exists. OPEC countries have made record incomes in recent years and have announced recently that due to the fracking boom in the U.S., they're going to cut production to keep international oil prices high. Isn't that convenient? It could be argued that the diamond, drug, and oil cartels have caused more instability and human suffering than any other business structures in history. They are anti-competitive and anti-free market. So for all these reasons, to say that the RFS skews the free market is nonsense. The petroleum market is anything but free. The RFS is a necessary policy to create and protect a modest level of diversity. And it's working. It needs to be allowed to continue to work and to grow as intended. It is a pathway to a freer market. It is pro-competitive, and it stimulates investment and innovation. Sorry, I got to do a Marco Rubio on you here. Just like when Big Blue initially shrugged off the fledgling personal computer market, then later determined that they had to have it all because they could, likewise, Big Oil initially wasn't concerned about the RFS because it had a bunch of subsidies for them. Now they have made it their stated top priority to kill the RFS and keep their subsidies. It's not enough that they are the richest industry in all of the history of human endeavor. They have to have it all because they can. And when Big Oil gets something in their gun sights, they have some pretty big bullets. The oil and gas industry spends over $100 million a year on lobbying and another estimated $70 million on campaign contributions. That's not even counting the advertising campaigns and funding quote-unquote research at think tanks to conclude that biofuels are bad. These are some of the same think tanks that concluded that climate change doesn't exist, conclude that the oil industry doesn't receive government support. They took this tactic from the tobacco companies in the 50s and perfected it to an art form. See, the tobacco companies just hired some doctors to say that smoking doesn't necessarily increase your risk of cancer. This creates a pseudo-debate, which puts it in the realm of unsettled science and relegates it back to opinion. All of this money being spent in this way is not just inconvenient for us, it's harmful. It's harmful to society. It's helped spawn a denial of science in general. This is why, according to NASA, 97% of climate scientists accept that there is anthropogenic climate change, but only 63% of American public believe them. The weird science that's being generated by these think tanks and funded by Big Brother's Ministry of Truth reminds me of another creation from the year 1984. Weird Science. I was 15 when that movie came out, and I just bought my own computer, Commodore 128. So that movie about two 15-year-old whiz kids who created a computer-generated woman was a hit with me. But what is really ironic is that this movie, made in 1984, had the most iconic Big Brother in all of movie history. Oh, Chet, aren't you a charmer? Almost makes you wonder whether John Hughes was giving a little tip of the hat to Orwell. So I can't resist reminding you of John Hughes' notion of Big Brother from the year 1984 and the movie Weird Science. Now, Chet has a little colorful language in this scene, so if you have delicate sensibilities, you might want to go earmuffs on this one. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Chet. Now, I hesitated to use the term big oil in this speech. You know, we have a lot of friends in the oil industry, a lot of customers. I was talking to John Maniscalco of the New York Oil Heat Association about it yesterday, and he said, "Doesn't bother me, I'm little oil." Or he said, "Doesn't bother me, I'm little oil." I can't do John Maniscalco. You know, he said, "I represent family businesses." So I think we should keep it in the family. And the family, our family members who are trying to kill the RFS, we should just refer to them as Chet. You know, family thing. Now, I was raised the middle child of three boys. I had a big brother, and I was a big brother. And I'm here to tell you that unless your parents enforce a strict policy that it is not okay to destroy your little brother, you get Chet. So Congress and President Bush passed the Anti-Chet Act of 2005, otherwise known as RFS-1. It was established to give biofuels a chance to get its foot in the door in order to attempt to diversify the transportation fuel supply in a similar way that the power generation supply is already highly diversified, which is why electricity is stable and affordable. But RFS-1 was a gasoline program. It didn't address the diesel side of the ledger. And as discussed earlier, it had plenty of special tax breaks for Chet as well. So that's why in March of 2006, a year after RFS was passed, Senator Obama introduced legislation to amend RFS-1, the American Fuels Act of 2006. It proposed the establishment of what came to be known as the alternative diesel standard. It proposed ramping up to 2 billion gallons of biodiesel in the diesel pool by 2015. That was 8 years ago, and today we're asking the EPA to raise biomass-based diesel category to 2.1 billion gallons for 2015. So throughout 2006 and 2007, the alternative diesel standard evolved into what became the RFS-2. Members of President Obama's own administration obviously don't remember this based on the proposed rule. But it is true that what became RFS-2 was first proposed by Senator Obama in order to diversify the diesel fuel supply. Let's take a look.
For all our military might, the Achilles heel of the most powerful nation on earth is the oil that we cannot live without. Osama bin Laden himself has said, and I'm quoting Mr. bin Laden here, "Focus your operations on oil, especially in Iraq and the Gulf area, since this will cause them to die off on their own. Moving away from an oil economy is a major challenge that is going to require sustained national commitment and may require some sacrifice from each of us. During World War II, we had an entire country working around the clock to produce enough planes and tanks to beat the Axis powers. When we wanted to beat the Russians into space, we poured millions into a national education initiative that graduated thousands of new scientists and engineers. If we hope to strengthen our security and create hundreds of thousands of new jobs, we can offer no less of a commitment when it comes to energy independence. With technology we have on the shelves right now, and fuels that we can grow right here on our soil, by 2025, we could reduce our oil imports by over 7.5 million barrels per day. And we should create a market for renewable fuels by ramping up renewable fuel standards and creating an alternative diesel standard.
By ramping up the renewable fuel standard and creating an alternative diesel standard. Does that sound familiar? This was early 2006, just after RFS1 was passed in 2005. Senator Obama's proposal was what became RFS2. And that vision, along with a lot of sweat and risk-taking from the people in this room, was realized. We did it. We achieved 5% of the diesel fuel supply with biodiesel and renewable diesel, and we did so in a way that increased jobs, stimulated the economy, and reduced carbon. Senator Lugar, who co-sponsored the bill, said this about Obama's proposal: by giving American consumers a real choice of automotive fuel, we must end oil's near monopoly on the transportation sector. Senator Obama saw his vision enacted into law in December 2007 with the passage of the ESA. It was his landmark policy success as a U.S. senator. He then went on to run for president, including biodiesel specifically as one of his priorities, and won. And he campaigned again in 2012 on renewable energy and biodiesel, and won again. Remember what Orwell said about the effectiveness of denying people of their history. The alternative diesel standard that called for 2 billion gallons of biodiesel requirement by 2015 was Senator Obama's vision, and it became the ESA, which was Senator Obama's landmark policy success. Yet individuals in his administration have forgotten this history. They have completely capitulated to big oil in what appears to be a complete policy of appeasement. In an effort to address the alcohol blend wall, the administration is proposing a rule that would effectively cut biodiesel production in half from current levels. This is nonsensical because biodiesel helps alleviate the alcohol blend wall. Senator Obama's policy vision is now President Obama's law to implement. The people in this room responded to that law by investing billions of dollars, putting it at risk to step up and comply with the law. And now the president's own administration is proposing not to comply with the law. The law that was his vision as a senator, that he campaigned on and won twice. It is mission critical that we remind President Obama and his administration of his history with this law. And we have to do so loudly and with such volume that the president himself hears it. Thank you. To do that, we'll have to turn up the gain and jam it up to 11, just like I did when I first pulled out that Van Halen cassette. We have to be strong and unified and loud and make our voices heard. But we can do it. We can win this. Henry Ford, who was not just the father of the affordable automobile, but also the father of renewable energy, once said, "Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right." History gives us glimpses of game-changing, pivotal moments in time. 2014 represents one of those pivotal moments, and it's up to us to make sure that 2014 does not become 1984, that big oil is not allowed to become big brother. Now, there's another famous quote that I like that's widely attributed to Steve Jobs. Here's to the crazy ones, the rebels, the troublemakers, the ones who see things differently, the people who are crazy enough to think that they can change the world are the ones who do. So I'll ask you, are we crazy enough to change the world? Well, let's get to it then. Thank you.